not a moron. That's not actually a moron. I think that's a little, I think that this title doesn't apply to this guest on this episode. Chris Stewart, thank you for coming on the podcast.
I'll embrace it.
You'll embrace it? Yeah. Moron? Yeah. Well, it's got the OU in it.
There have been times.
It's like
I feel like I've matured a little.
It's a special type of moron. It's a
more OU-in.
Yeah, a more OU-in. Chris Stewart, employee here at the Scripps College. Basically, big reason this entire podcast studio, which we've switched locations now, big reason this entire podcast studio is up and running, and you kind of make sure that this entire building keeps on rolling and everything doesn't fall apart at the seams here with all the events we have going on at Scripps College. You're also a published author, Athens local, coached the Athens Bulldog baseball team as the head coach for, what, 4 years?
Head coach for 5 years.
Head coach for five.
I was with the team for 13 and not finished.
But you're still coaching?
Yeah, Coach Newsom's on a fantastic job, and he will be there as long as he wants to be there, I'm sure. And if the window ever opens up at Athens again, I'd love to go back. But if it opens up somewhere else, I might jump through it as soon as my kids are done playing in college.
Yeah, and the reason you stepped aside is because your son's playing college baseball, right?
That's half the reason. The other half is because my daughter is in high school. She's a senior this year, which would have made her a junior last year, which was the first year I'd stepped aside. And I had actually never gotten to see her play live. The baseball team and the softball team play at the exact same time.
Yep.
And we rode the bus together, and then I said good luck, and then I never saw her again until that night when we would sit down on the couch and watch film that my wife would take for us. And so watching on film is one thing together, but getting to sit there and watch live is a whole other thing. And so I needed to really focus on spending time with her for these last 2 years. It's been really, really great, really sweet.
Especially, you know, coaching her. Like, is it there more of a connection there? Like,
definitely.
Do you feel like your relationship has grown over?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I always coach my kids individually, you know, just at home or, you know, whenever they ask to go out in the yard and throw or to go down and hit or whatever, I would always coach them individually. Never on my terms, but always on theirs. If they wanted to do it, then they would ask me and I would make myself available to do it. But then the head softball coach did come up to my house last fall and ask if I would be willing to sit in the dugout with them and provide whatever input that I felt the program needed. And I was perfectly content with going out and buying a lawn chair and being a dad and sitting there. But he kind of talked me into, it's hard when coaching's in your blood and it's in your veins, you really want to keep doing it. So I've been there. I'm a bench coach for the softball team and I really enjoy game days because I get to chat with the girls and help them prepare in the dugout. But I provide a lot of, he gives me a lot of opportunity and freedom to interject myself a little bit in on practice days. And those are my favorite days anyway, as a coach. So.
See, your passion in terms of parenting and coaching and sports, I think is the exact right passion.
Thank you.
It's
not always been.
No, and it's just kind of, it's a comment on society of, hey, you're focused on your kids in sports. You care about their future career. You care about how good they are at that said sport, how that sport builds their character. But you're not one of these, which are becoming much more common, insane, fanatic parents that we see at these high school games. And you and I are there. We see it both sides, all around.
Yeah, we hear it right behind us. Yeah.
We hear it everywhere. And the parents are...
I sometimes will slip into that a little bit, you know. I confess.
I find that hard to believe. What's your worst example then? What's the one time you were not proud as a viewer, as a parent, you felt like you maybe stepped over the line?
Well, I guess I've never, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm one of those insane people that has done something that has really embarrassed myself and my kids and my wife and everything, and I got escorted out of the gym or away from the field. But there are times when I, after the game, when I will think to myself, when I get a chance to ponder how I behaved, I regret saying some things like coaching advice from the stands. It's hard to not do that, you know. When you're there and you're watching as a fan, you should just watch and enjoy watching your kids play and watching the team play. The coach, I'm a coach, and so I always hated hearing fans and moms and dads yelling coaching advice. And so here I am, you know, as a parent, doing the same thing that I hate. And so those are times when I regret, making those kinds of statements.
But it's definitely different from what is causing the shortage of officials at the youth levels.
Well, sure, that's not.
I mean,
that's not contributing to that.
Oh, without a doubt. And for those of you that don't know, there's a real epidemic in youth sports, especially at the high school level, of not having enough qualified officials to officiate these youth games because they are saying it's not worth the pay. It's not worth it's not worth the verbal abuse. It's not worth the pressure. It's not worth all those things that put on it. And it's just a real shame to see parents kind of almost pulling the game out from underneath of these kids, because now we have less qualified officials because the job is becoming less sought after. They're looking for essentially anybody to fill these roles. And then the games get worse officiated, and the problem stacks on top of each other.
Yeah, people that aren't ready yet to officiate at a certain level are having are being called upon to have to step up if they're if they're a class two official or whatever, they're being called upon to step up and
so
be a class.
When you hear a parent like that, do you ever say, have you ever said anything to somebody that was being a little over the line? Have you ever, or have you just kind of sat back?
I have as a coach. There have been times when I've looked up in the stands and just kind of given one of these, if someone were to, it's hard to volunteer that, that kind of advice for people that are pretty emotional in the moment, but it's always better, I think, in a conversational atmosphere afterwards. In the heat of the moment during an athletic contest, people are, they're completely irrational. In many ways, and so to have that kind of interaction with them is just going to escalate things even worse, I think. And so that's the reason I, when I started a blog, turned it into a book. One of the chapters actually ended up being the official is not your opponent, and it gave me a platform to be able to talk a little bit about my failures as a coach and as a parent in the past, and tell some of those stories, and to just help people get perspective and then kind of be able to point them that direction. In fact, my wife has used that against me a little bit this year during the basketball season. I remember, I said something and she kind of elbowed me and said, "What chapter is that in your book, Chris?"
So, yes, that's awesome.
Right. It was good. I needed it. We all need that. And that's the kind of reminder, that we have. And I was writing mostly from a perspective of a coach at that point, but then there was also a lot of opportunity to speak with parents about, using people who had bought the book and read it and said, "Hey, I really appreciate that. It really challenged me." And some people actually were talking with me about that particular chapter while sitting in the stands preparing to watch their kids' game.
Yeah.
And that gave us a chance to talk a little bit about, I'll hold you accountable here tonight.
So the book started with a blog.
It did.
And you just started writing. You just found a passion for writing, giving advice from what you've learned from your experiences, and I find that really cool that you kind of developed something and then you were able to craft it into a book.
Yeah.
But how do you get the motivation? I mean, that's the real question. Is I think we're all capable of writing, but writing a book is a legitimate dedication. It's a day in, day out thing. You have to have a long-term plan. You have to have ideas that fit in. You've got to edit the whole thing. Where'd you find that motivation to do that?
I've always had a desire to write, and actually the idea to write a book was something that I came up with probably 7 or 8 years ago. I, in fact, started a file folder on my laptop that said book idea. And I started a Word document, started jotting down some ideas, put it in that folder, and then really never came back to it at all. I was in the middle of coaching, and coaching is not just a seasonal job. It's a supplemental position, of course, at the high school level. You can't live on it. Or even if you're, obviously as a volunteer, it's the same thing. But still, it's a year-round commitment. I mean, if you really want to instill the kind of success in your team and your players that you desire from them, you've got to commit all year round, to strength training, to mental conditioning, things like that as well. And so I just didn't have time to continue. The idea was always there. Where it really kind of, the fire really lit up again for me was when I knew that I was going to resign from coaching. From coaching baseball at Athens High School, I knew that I couldn't just stop coaching.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to think of ideas, ways to continue pouring into people. Because for me, coaching had become, I felt like I was just beginning to figure out what coaching was all about. I used to coach a sport, And in the last couple of years of my coaching at the high school level, I was starting to learn that coaching is about coaching a person and an entire team of persons, you know. And then if we can get those people, those kids, those students, those student athletes to be in a good place, both you know, mentally, physically, emotionally, intellectually, socially, if we can help them in all aspects of their life, then they're going to perform at the highest possible possible potential on the field as well. And just when I decided, you know, just when I felt like I was starting to get that, when it was starting to click, that's when I decided to resign. And so this, you know, this was, yeah. And so I was, you know, I was motivated. I was jazzed about, you know, really continuing. And to be honest with you, the team was very successful. We went to the regional championship 2 years in a row. We knew we had a good young group of talent coming up last year. That, you know, we graduated 11 seniors, and these kids, you know, young kids last year stepped up for Coach Newsom, and they went to the district championship. You know, and I think they'll compete again this year, probably next year. And so
they've
really
got
difficult.
They've
yeah.
got a talented squad.
Absolutely.
And just. It's interesting that you had this epiphany at one, some would consider the worst time to have that epiphany,
sure.
near
yeah.
the end of your coaching career. But I think you knew that it was just time to shift away for a minute. To kind
of
change.
The middle of the coaching career. So
yeah.
It's a different type of
it's
coaching.
Just,
yeah.
It's a different type. It's like a life right. coaching. It's giving advice. It's affecting people's lives. And I think that it's very interesting that you're driven by affecting other people's lives. And that's
right.
a very positive thing to be driven by. And I think that there's a lot of people in this world that aren't ever driven by affecting other people's lives. And that's why we see so many relationships fail. That's why we see so many things in our world that just nobody's trying to fix each other. Not necessarily fix each other, but nobody's trying to be there or give advice. Or, hey,
yeah.
I remember I was in this situation and I'm going to help these people out. Or I'm going to do this thing. And I had this great story, and it's just kind of about connecting people and understanding that we need to stop having a negative view of the world. Mm-hmm. Is I was traveling to Minnesota this past week, and flying into Rochester from Chicago. So we're in Chicago. There's some maintenance problems with the plane, of course. But I've been flying since I was 6 months old, so I'm just taking the hits as they go. I've got a book, really interesting book about Newt Rockne. But that's beside
okay.
the point. And I'm reading this book, and I'm calm on the plane, and they have us deplane because there's fog in Minnesota. They don't think we're going to be able to land. Then they have us get up back on the plane. They say, "Hey, we've got a window. Let's try to get you to Rochester." And so the flight's full. It's kind of hectic. And I just start talking to the woman across the aisle from me. Very interesting woman. Her name's Camille Williams. So happy that I got to meet her. I think she's going to listen to this podcast. So,
oh, nice.
Because she was just an intriguing person, and I just kept asking questions. I was interested about what she had to say, what her experience had been in life. And so we really hit it off. And we got along on the plane. We get to Rochester, the city. We circle the city for 30 minutes because the fog, the
yeah.
visibility went back down. And then they turn us around and say, "We're taking you back."
My goodness.
Well, I've got a tournament that I've got to be at in Rochester, Minnesota. I've got to be there, and Camille has to be there as well. So we've hit it off on the plane, and she says, "Well, hey, you want to get a rental car, split the cost, and drive it to Rochester? It's like a 5-hour drive." And my two options were get into this car with this still stranger. I've talked to her, but I don't know anything about her. Or do I be on my lonesome, put my headphones in, buy my Greyhound ticket, and sit on that bus for 10 to 15 hours and just live my life? And there are so many people in our generation
mm-hmm.
who would not have gotten in that rental car.
Sure.
I got a lot of text messages, a lot of Snapchats. "What are you doing with a stranger in a rental car? Haven't you seen any movies?" Here's the reality of the situation.
Yeah.
The odds that she was a murderer.
We go to the worst possible conclusion in our
right.
minds.
Like, why go to the worst possible
right.
conclusion, right? Stranger danger is a thing, and you need to be careful in life, but
you can handle yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I was like,
someone
one
named Camille. You can handle yourself, don't you think?
Yeah, I thought I was fine. I'm like, I'm bigger than this. Even if she tried to kill me, maybe I could get out
yeah.
of it, right? I did that little math. But what are the odds that a woman I met randomly on a plane to
yeah.
Rochester, who did not want to, I was the one that engaged the conversation,
mm-hmm.
who, why, she was going to plan on the plane not landing in Rochester? She planned on all this to
yeah, right.
to have, and I just didn't get that.
It took a lot of faith from her as well.
No,
she's
exactly.
Getting in a car with a strange man that she's just met as well.
So. Yeah, and she got some advice. And my thing is, this used to be done a lot more before the invention of social media. And we've created these bubbles in life that I've got my people, I've got my friends, and everybody else is a danger to me and to society.
Yeah.
And that's a bad attitude to have, I think. I think we need to be open. We need to be trying to help people. And that's exactly what you've done with your book. You've expanded out this advice that you were just giving to Athens players. Well, now the entire region can read this advice.
Sure.
The coaches can read this advice. And I think that people like that, attitudes like that, connecting people across all different generations, all different regions, all different backgrounds, is so much more important in today's society. And I think we're really forgetting that a lot of times.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's an attitude of selflessness. I mean, and you know, I think the contributing to all of the, you know, the mindset that you just described, that, you know, that came from those text messages and Instagram posts and things like that, or whatever, however you got them, is this social media world where I am in the center of it. I'm completely in the center. It's all about me. I'm taking pictures of myself and putting it on my feed, and, you know, this is what I ate today, you know, this is what I'm going to cook for my kids tonight. This is what it's just completely self-consumed and narcissistic in so many ways, and we forget that the greatest satisfaction that we're ever going to get in life is serving someone else, is pouring yourself into someone else, is kind of forgetting about yourself for just a minute and realize that when I step out of my comfort zone and I either, you know, help someone else, in your case, you weren't necessarily serving someone else, you were just getting to know someone else.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of an adventure, you know, in a way. But how does anyone become a friend when they were a stranger at some point?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, those are the experiences that you have to have, and you never know what kind of connection you just made, what kind of networking you may have just created for your own self and your own career. You know, I don't know what Camille does or who, you know,
well,
where she's linked in, but now she's probably a friend of yours on social
exactly,
media.
Exactly. Yeah.
And yeah.
And Camille actually, luckily for me, has a lot of really great life experience. Mm-hmm. And she's...
Yeah, and so you learned.
She's been awesome. I learned from her, and she's just already been awesome. I feel so lucky. I thought the most valuable part of this trip was that I was going to get 6 games of play-by-play and 6 games of color in 3 days and make a little bit of freelancing money. That's all I thought I got. Instead, I got one of my more valuable connections I've had in my career. And it's not because I got it. It's literally just because I decided to talk to somebody on a plane. And for journalism...
What a great perspective.
And for journalism majors out there, if you sit down on a plane next to somebody and you don't even ask them a question, where are you going? Why are you going there? If you can't even muster that to a stranger, you're in the wrong profession, because mm-hmm. you're a storyteller. Right? Now, I met another guy on the plane on the way back from Rochester. His name was Ed. He's from Minnesota, right? And he was just a sweet guy. And he told me an amazing story about how he met his first wife, which was he had this medallion. He found it really special. He was traveling all across Minnesota as a salesman. He lost his medallion in Mankato in between a house and a Sears. He didn't know where he lost it.
Yeah.
Forgot about the medallion. Still traveling around. Goes to a restaurant in Mankato 2 years later. Hostess comes up, she's very pretty, he says hi, looks down, she's wearing the same medallion, and he goes, where'd you get that medallion? He says, well, I was just walking with my mom, and I saw in a snowbank, and I picked it up, and I've just
man, had it's a movie script.
I had it ever since, and he goes, and he says, I'm a religious man, and it felt like God was telling me that this was the woman, and then he made a joke, he said, well, that was my first wife, so maybe God wasn't right. But
well, or maybe he didn't hear him.
Maybe something along
those lines. I'm going to take the blame when it comes between, you know, is it, who's wrong here, myself or God, right?
Exactly. And just that story, I was like, that's incredible. Everybody has a story.
That is.
In
that's
life.
Great.
And that is what emphasize to everybody. Everybody needs to realize about that yourself. Your story is unique, mm-hmm. and a good storyteller can find that story and tell it. Everybody's got a story. Everybody's got a hardship. Yeah. Everybody has something to work through. And I think that learning of those other experiences and meeting other people is so crucial to, you know, functioning as a human properly. And right now, we don't have good storytelling mechanisms through social media, because everybody tells you the story they want you to see.
Oh, yeah, right? Absolutely. So yeah, we're able to stage it.
Exactly. All the friends on spring break, I saw all the good moments.
Sure.
Did I see the moments, you know, at 9 a.m. probably when they woke up with the biggest headache of their life? No. But that's also part of the story.
Moments when they're just arguing. They're just not getting along. You know, I mean, just you don't see those posted on social media, you know, that you see the beautiful moments. So.
And that really has, I think, and I want to get your opinion on this, the really plague, the epidemic of depression and suicidal tendencies in our youth, especially the modern generation. It started with, I think, it's from 95 on. That's really when it started. And then my wave, I caught the back end of smartphones. We were the first little wave of kids that had text message, Twitter, Facebook throughout high school. I was the first little generation of that. And since that point, the problem's only gotten worse. It just, I think that everybody, when you're sad and you go look on social media and you have this perception that the entire world is happy, it just does not do well for mental health.
That's exactly right. You know, I am not an anti-social media person. I'm not an old fogey. I actually really enjoy, I was on Twitter before my kids. I was on, you know, I think the only app I don't use is Snapchat. That's actually one that makes me old probably, is that I've never really embraced Snapchat.
You know, I wouldn't embrace it either if all my friends were. Yeah, that's kind of my thing. Everybody else is on it, so I'm gonna hop on.
And so I'm never gonna say that there's not that social media is evil. I don't believe anything in and of itself is evil. I think there's incredible good to it, and I embrace all progress, and I embrace, you know, I embrace change, and I'm willing to think about it and how it can be utilized for good, and there is a lot of good to all of this, all of the social media. But you are absolutely correct. I don't know the data, so I can't speak factually. But we, you know, the eye test, it certainly passes the eye test that there is a lot of.
Well, Jared, could you actually Google that real quick? Go ahead and Google youth depression, youth suicide rates, because I really want to get the numbers.
Just this past week, we've had news locally of you know, incidents like that, and you know, I don't want to speak to. I don't know why, you know, why. You know, those kinds of decisions were made by individuals. But you know, there have been two different particular stories of people that are in my circle of relationship. You know, that were tragic.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know if it has anything to do with social media, but
it's not. It's not just because. And you know, I know people who have a chemical issue in terms of the brain is not operating. Right. Properly, it does not have the correct chemicals, and those need to be fixed by medicine. And that's not a social media thing,
right?
But social media doesn't help.
No,
I don't think that the way social media is constructed.
Well, and you know, one way that it doesn't help probably as well is more of a backdoor sort of way, which is when we're so consumed with our social media, we're so consumed with walking around with our head down, we don't observe other people when they are hurting. We don't see it. We're not able to hear the cries that they're not just gonna come out and tell us, you know, hey, I'm depressed and I'm gonna kill myself. They're gonna tell us in other ways. Their body language is gonna show it. They're gonna, you know, in conversation, you're gonna be able to have moments where you say, hey, is everything okay? But if we never have those kinds of conversations, because all we ever do is text, you can't have that same kind of conversation.
Or just looking somebody in the eye and go,
sure,
how are you?
Right.
No, legitimately, how are you? Don't tell me you're good, like everybody else does. What's really going on?
Yeah.
And that's what friends are.
And I want to say this too. I don't think that young people today, I don't think that it's that they don't care to ask that question.
Yeah.
I really think we don't know how. I think in many ways we don't know how to communicate, because our most common ways of communicating are through these mediators, you know, through phones or through the computer or through some kind of mediator, as opposed to sitting right across from someone looking in the eye.
It's absolutely insane. It's insane. I mean, I'll just look at my relationship when I was 14 to 18. We would communicate our mood by what type of text we sent to start the conversation. If it was, hey, babe, everything's good.
Right.
If it's, hey, babe, everything's real good. If it's, hey, something's wrong.
And you might even, that question may come just from hearing, hey, you the very next text might be, what's wrong?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what it was. Yeah. And you said, hey, without the babe to signify that something was wrong. And these are
you intended it that way, right?
Yes, exactly. And these are real social norms that we've never had in society to deal with. Jared, do you have something to
Yeah, according to the American Foundation, Oh, yeah, sorry. According to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, suicide in youth has steadily increased slightly since the mid-2000s. In 2008, this has the rate per 100,000 individuals. In 2008, it was 11.6 youth between the ages of 14 and 19 committed suicide, and in 2017 it was 14. So it raised three
per thousand. Yeah.
Three per.
That's a lot. That's a lot of kids. Think about how many kids there are. That's just sad.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just sad. The fact that our life expectancy in the United States went down for the first time ever, and it's not because of, it's not because our medicine is getting worse, and I think part of it is the healthcare system.
It's not because natural death is occurring sooner.
No, right.
It's because, one, the opiate epidemic is taking out so many people, especially in this area. Drug abuse and things like that are taking out so many people. And suicide rates. Yeah. I mean, we experience the amount of suicides we have in this country is terrifying. And I think it's something that was a problem, it has been a problem in the past before, but it's a very modern affliction, because the mind is meant to have stress. It is supposed to be stress. That is our natural state. That's how we survive. That's evolution. Stress for eating, you gotta go hunt, right? Stress for surviving, you gotta be aware and active. Is that a tiger in the bush? I'm stressed out, right? Figuring things out. So we've done such a good job as a human race of eliminating the stressors. Nobody in this country is worrying about, well, I'm not, I don't want to say that. There are people in this country that worry about where the next meal is coming from. But the majority of people, a vast majority, know where the next meal is coming from. They know that when it rains, they have somewhere to sleep. They know that they're comfortable. They can get food, they can travel, they can watch TV. They have all the things you need. So the brain then sits there, and it does not have a natural stressor, so it places stressors on you. And a lot of people associate that with school. A dream, a goal, and that can be positive. It can stress you. Like, hey, I want to finish that book. That's a stressor for you. You get up in the morning, you do it. But what happens is the brain is just feeling stress, and then we'll often apply stress to things that don't really matter, and it's just a loop. Mm-hmm. And then so you have this modern affliction of too much time to think, nothing to do. And I think that's why, you know, you emphasize in your book kind of work ethic.
Right.
And things like, and how positive that can be to have something that you're going for every day, a goal, a dream, an aspiration. You set a standard and you try to achieve it. And just, how'd you talk about that in your book? What's your advice in terms of how to establish, how does somebody that doesn't have a direction in life, and this direction is causing their brain to place stressors on things that don't matter, like, I only got 50 likes and they got 150, or nobody likes me because they don't agree with my comments on this. How do they shift that to an actionable goal, an actionable plan of moving forward and giving their brain a positive stressor?
Well, one of the things that I have personally emphasized and have implemented into my own life over the past, really, I mean, fairly recently, in the past few years, and I guess over the course of my entire adult life, I did in some way, but very much more specifically here in the last couple years, I've just eliminated goal setting, and let me explain.
Okay.
Because
this is intriguing.
Right, and it's not necessarily that I don't have goals. It's that I don't focus on my goals. I focus on a system. A pattern of behavior every single day.
Yeah.
And when you have a system, when a person develops for themselves a system of how I'm going to live, how I'm going to behave, then you also have goals that you know you want to reach in your life, but you're focused on your system, which is every minute, every day. I mean, not necessarily every minute, but just, you know, this is what I do every day. And as I am consistent with that system, you're going to reach your goals. But then what happens then, when a person reaches a goal, then you've got a decision to make. Do I celebrate and say, I did it, good deal, I'm done? Or do I continue on and create new goals? You know, hopefully everyone will say, I'll create new goals.
Yeah.
You know, one just very practical example I'll give about this, and I actually use this in Building Champions, is a lot of people
will check out Building Champions on Amazon.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Check it out.
The common goal during this time of the year is is especially if you're from January all the way to June, July, is I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to get that beach body because I've got a family vacation in July, and so I need to get in shape. You know, I'm fat from the holidays and the wintertime, and I'm going to join a gym. I'm going to diet, and I'm going to exercise, and I'm going to be very disciplined. Well, and that goal then that is in our mind is July 7th, whatever that vacation date is. And there's a very fixed goal, right? So I want to weigh this much by this date. I want to look like this. I want to have this size waist by this date. And when we go to the beach, it's going to show. And so you even maybe will put a picture up on the refrigerator of what you looked like, you know, back when you were in better shape. And you have that as a goal. That's great. You know, it's a good thing to do. And so a person will go and they'll work out. They'll keep that commitment because they have that goal in mind. They go on vacation. While you're on vacation, you let your guard down a little bit. You go eat whatever you want, a few seafood buffets, a few desserts. Get back from vacation, you don't really think about it as much. Why? Because the goal's behind you, right? The goal's, you've reached the goal. And so what happens is this vicious cycle continues where we just kind of dip back into poor habits, poor behaviors, poor just daily routines, because we were focused on a goal. We weren't focused on who am I? You know, this is the kind of person I am. And so it's not, I want to weigh this much by this date, or I want to be, you know, I want to do this. A goal is something that's out in the future. But if I have a system for how I'm going to live and behave, that's present right now. That's who I am. And so it changes the way I speak about myself. It changes the way I think about myself. It's no longer, hey, I want to be a person who is in shape someday. It's I'm a person I'm a person who works out. I work out. This is who I am. You know, to think of a better example. If someone wants to stop smoking, let's say someone's a smoker and they want to stop, and that's their goal. You know, it's one thing to say, hey.